From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. And now the final installment of our occasional series, Shifting Ground, about America's changing landscape. This is the story of a widow, a farm, and a final request. Independent producer David Barron spent 2 years following one landowner's efforts to use her own death as a way to preserve the land she loves.
Joan Graham has been on this earth 80 years, and in that time, she's acquired a number of things. 2 artificial hips, 2 husbands whom she outlived, a 157-acre parcel of Michigan woods and farmland, and a passion for the outdoors.
I just like the earth. I like the smell of it, and I like green, and I like trees.
She plants trees around her farmhouse.
This is a tulip tree.
She tends them.
Those are walnut trees.
So she wasn't happy when, a few years ago, trees started coming down on the lot across the road.
It's going to be a subdivision. I hate to think of what it's going to look like.
To protect her land, Joan Graham decided to bequeath it to a local conservation group. The group promised not to develop the property after she's gone. But then she thought, why should she have to go? So she made the following request. When she dies, she wants to be buried on her property, beneath an oak.
They have deep taproots. Well, wouldn't it be nice if that oak tree would ever reach my remains and the tree would take nourishment from that? And it's kind of like, well, I never died, really. I just morphed into a tree or something.
But her request to the conservation group, the Six Rivers Regional Land Conservancy, didn't end there. Donna Foland is the group's executive director.
She said that she would like to share it. She would welcome others who would want to be buried there.
On the farm?
On the farm, yeah.
Had you ever had a property owner make this request to you?
No. No. It was brand new.
And it was not exactly uncontroversial. Joan Graham's proposal was to turn a portion of the farm into a highly unusual cemetery, an environmentally friendly one with no embalming, no fertilized lawn, just bodies interred in biodegradable caskets or shrouds with rocks and trees as grave markers. Donna Foland brought the idea to her board.
The first reactions varied from, oh, that sounds lovely, just an immediate warming to it, to people who thought it was pretty kooky, like maybe we shouldn't be engaged with crazy ideas like that.
But the more Foland thought about the idea, the more excited she grew. You see, one of the challenges of conservation is getting the public to feel invested in protecting land. Foland realized that burying bodies on the farm would make the land sacred, a place people would always want to preserve. But was this plan legal? How would she do it?
Nice to meet you. I'm Donna.
Tom Lynch. Pleasure. Have a seat. Thanks.
For advice, she sought out a prominent Michigan funeral director, Thomas Lynch. They sat in his office, a formal room with dark wood and subdued light.
So you want to take a natural field, woods, and just say, let's put our dead in here. And by doing so, we're sort of upping the conservancy ante. Because once people have buried their dead, they're disinclined to put, you know, a bookstore there.
Yes, I believe so.
That makes good sense.
And
Lynch said no laws barred the idea. Bodies don't have to be embalmed, for instance. But any cemetery would have to meet state regulations. Donna Foland came away energized but cautious.
It's not something that I would be able to do on my own, and that our conservancy certainly would want to do. We need other partners to be in the lead with certain details.
She contacted an organization called the Green Burial Council. It's trying to jumpstart a movement toward more environmentally friendly cemeteries in the U.S. The group's founder, Joe Sihe, came to Michigan, met with Joan Graham on her farm, and agreed to help with the project.
It's a beautiful gift that Joan is giving to a lot of people. Her last act on earth could be incredibly meaningful and could do a lot of wonderful things for a lot of years.
Sihe said what the Land Conservancy needed was a partner in the cemetery business, and he had an idea.
Based on our preliminary research, it seems like one of the most promising possibilities is a partnership with the township.
Joe, my name is Mike Nolan. I'm the attorney for Metamora Township. In the room with me is...
With Joe Sheehy on the phone, the Conservancy's Donna Folan sat down with local officials last year. She provided some background.
This is a photograph of part of the area where the burial ground is proposed to be in.
Then Joe Sheehy made a pitch. What if the township operated the burial ground as an annex to its existing cemetery? He argued the new green cemetery would help protect the land, and it could bring revenue to the town.
If we use the figure of $3,300 per plot, we see $2.3 million coming from that.
The presentation didn't go over well. Township officials declined to speak on tape, but they weren't sold on the concept. Bodies buried in the woods? What if a loved one visiting a grave tripped over a fallen log? Who'd be liable? And Donna Folan says officials were skeptical of the finances.
I could see their side of things. I mean, I think we have to show them more than theoretical numbers that that it was going to work. So they were not interested in taking on that responsibility.
Donna Folan kept looking for partners. She courted private cemetery operators. Some seemed interested at first, but they too weren't sure in the end that they could make the concept work as a business. Now, more than 2 years since Joan Graham made her request, Donna Folan says fulfilling it has proved surprisingly difficult.
The details are a lot more complicated than I ever expected.
But Donna Folan hasn't given up, and neither has Joan Graham.
I'm determined to go ahead with it.
Though she has changed tactics slightly. She threw a party this fall, an afternoon of wine and hay rides and sing-alongs by the barn.
She knows them all.
It was a harvest festival, but with another purpose. You see, even if Joan Graham can't make a formal green cemetery a reality, she can establish a tiny private one. So that's the plan now. In essence, a family plot up the hill by the woodlot. At the party, she recruited volunteers.
I wouldn't mind if other people joined me up there, as long as they're willing to be a flower or a tree.
Her friends were charmed.
I'm going to be a candidate. I am.
And among the most enthusiastic volunteers was Donna Folan from the Land Conservancy.
If there was a place for me, that would be good. I would like that for myself.
After 2 years trying to sell the concept of green burial, she says she's sold on it herself. For NPR News, I'm David Barron.
Me quiero morir. This night I want to die.
Very good, very good.
I think he's sitting in a barn.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Restaurants pay about $100 a month to have someone come haul away their used oil, along with the crispy bits left over from all the French fries, beer-battered shrimp, and chicken wings that were fried in it. James Perrette, a mechanical engineer, thought that was both wasteful and expensive, so he came up with the VeggieWatt. It's a small generator that sits out back behind the restaurant's kitchen door, and it turns that grease into energy. Energy to power the restaurant. Now, all this month, we've been looking at some of the clever inventions of 2009. And James Perrette joins me to talk about his. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So how does it work? How does your machine work?
Well, our machine filters out all of the food crumbs, the beer-battered shrimp and onion rings and the gunk that you mentioned earlier. It heats it up to a point where the engine, which is a standard diesel engine or an industrial diesel engine, can utilize the oil. Diesel engine turns a generator head, which produces electricity, which then is fed back into the restaurant. The diesel engine also produces a lot of heat, and the restaurant can use that to produce hot water or for space heating. There's an added benefit there, so we've harnessed that for the restaurant. Our overall efficiency is actually around 70%.
So presumably that could save them a lot of money in energy bills.
Oh, exactly. We can save them, you know, $10,000, $20,000 a year.
Now, how many restaurants are using the VeggieWatt so far?
Right now we have 3 locations in place.
Mm-hmm.
We have orders for an additional 3.
And these are restaurants that do mostly fried foods?
These are all types of restaurants. You know, oil is a very expensive resource for a restaurant. They want to get as much life out of it as possible. And now we have a device that we can sell to restaurants where restaurants are very motivated to put all of their oil into the device because they own it and they get the benefit of it.
Hmm. Now, I've heard about people using used vegetable oil to run their cars. Is this basically the same principle?
It's a quantum leap from that principle. Biodiesel is a chemical conversion of vegetable oil into a transesterified product. We don't undergo a chemical conversion.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of altering the chemistry of the fuel, we alter the engine so that it inherently can burn the raw fuel.
So now I guess one of the added benefits that you would get from the machine is that you would always have this wonderful smell of French fries wafting from the back of the restaurant.
You do have that wonderful smell of French fries, but unfortunately, standing next to the system, usually they're located in dumpster corrals, so it smells like dumpster.
Like dumpster and French fries. And tempura shrimp?
It really depends on the menu options of the restaurant of what the dumpster smells like.
I think you should market this to funnel cake makers. That's James Perrette. He's the inventor of the VegiWatt. It's a generator that turns the used oil from a restaurant's deep fryer and sends it right back into the restaurant as electricity. He joined us from his home in Massachusetts. James Perrette, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.
Now, a story about the number one producer of greenhouse gases in California. That distinction goes to the Chevron Corporation's oil refinery in the Bay Area town of Richmond, just east of San Francisco. The refinery opened more than a century ago. In spite of the bad air, Richmond has been a loyal company town until lately. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The Chevron refinery is nestled on a bank of hills right next to the San Francisco Bay. It's a Byzantine complex of tanks, steam boilers, and 8,000 miles of piping.
We're at about 2,900 acres. The refinery produces jet fuel, gasoline, and diesel as high-value products, and also lubricating oil.
That's Dean O'Hare, my guide for a driving tour of the refinery.
About 20 to 25% of the gasoline market is supplied by Chevron. So we're a regionally important facility from that standpoint as well.
Over the past century, the Richmond refinery has prospered, helping Chevron to make billions of dollars in profits. And those profits are a target of the city's green mayor, Gail McLaughlin, who has been trying to raise Chevron's local taxes.
What makes this fair is Richmond has suffered, especially in the neighborhoods around the refinery, among the highest rates of asthma, cancer, heart disease, due to pollution that has come from the refinery.
McLaughlin backed a voter effort to raise Chevron's business license fees, a measure a judge later overturned. Tensions over this and other tax disputes causes company officials to hint that it may be time to leave Richmond. Mike Coyle is the refinery's general manager.
The Richmond refinery has been here well over 100 years, and we've had good times and bad times. Nobody likes divorce.
Richmond's mayor thinks Chevron's talk of moving is a bluff, but the company says it needs to stay competitive. And to do that, it wants to make some major technical upgrades to the refinery. But so far, a local judge has temporarily blocked that, pending more environmental review. Meanwhile, Chevron's local critics on the street are emboldened.
Chevron is a corporate polluter. They really don't care nothing about the lives of our people in our community.
That's Henry Clark, environmental activist and longtime Chevron antagonist.
We will stop these international greenhouse gangsters from Richmond, from North Richmond to Nigeria to Ecuador.
Chevron is trying to boost its local image. It says it will spend more than $3 million this year helping Richmond's nonprofits and economic development projects.
So my name is Candia Mosley. I'm the director of sales and marketing at Solar Richmond.
One of those groups is Solar Richmond, which trains workers on how to install solar panels on homes. We're standing on a hill overlooking a new housing development capped with solar panels installed by its trainees. The company just received a small grant from Chevron to train another 45 workers. Mosley said her green firm didn't hesitate to take Chevron's money.
Chevron is grappling with what it means to be a 21st century corporate citizen. And I think to the extent that we can figure out ways to work together to accelerate renewable energy adoption and also create employment opportunities right here at home in Richmond, we want to be a part of that work.
Winning new friends could forestall talk of the refinery leaving, Still, many are wondering how the marriage between Chevron and the city of Richmond can be saved. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News.